Hello and welcome to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I'm Ralph Russo, college football writer with the Associated Press. On today's show, Adam Rittenberg from ESPN joins me to put a bow on the January coaching carousel that started with Nick Saban's retirement bombshell and ended last week with Michigan's most unsurprising promotion of Sharon Moore to replace Jim Harbaugh. But before we do that, Adam and I talk about how to process the cheating scandal that threatened to derail and sort of hung over like a cloud Michigan's season. It very much different. In fact, the question is, should Michigan's title be tarnished forever? Or did the Wolverines redeem themselves by winning it all anyway? Thanks for listening to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. You can find us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and just about anywhere you like to get your pods. If you like what you hear, please give us a good rating and review. It helps college football fans find us. It helps us find more college football fans. And away we go. Joining me this week on the podcast, the great Adam Rittenberg from ESPN, my friend. Adam, thank you so much for jumping on today. How's it going? Off-season kicking in yet?
Yeah, no, not yet. I mean, I think the Michigan coaching hire was the last thing that we hope will, you know, propel us into the off season. So it's been kind of a long December and January, so to speak. But yeah, glad that everything is at least set for now in terms of coaching movement. And now we're kind of spinning forward to 2024.
Okay, I want to put a bow on Michigan this way, and I kind of want to go back to the scandal. I want to go back to the sign stealing, because now that they've won the championship and Harbaugh's moved on, there is still something of a debate about, I don't know if it's a debate, it's sort of this dialogue about, well, how you should view Michigan's success over the last few years and this championship, and there are still penalties to come from the NCAA. We're not really exactly sure what those penalties will be. Hard to really gauge the NCAA these days because it's in the middle of sort of a transition and it's handing out penalties in a different way. But I got to say, Adam, like I'm a little ambivalent to this all. And it goes back to where this all started, which was at its very core, if sign stealing is okay, but this type of sign stealing is not okay, it's hard for me to sort of figure out what the value is of it. They definitely broke the rules, and clearly there was value because they were doing it. But then I find myself stumbling around going, so is this a misdemeanor? Is this a felony? Yeah. Is this speeding? Is this reckless driving? Is this a DUI? Like, that matters, and I'm having a hard time figuring out sort of, again, so I'm a little bit ambivalent. I saw them win a championship after the scandal broke and thought, okay, like they're going to get penalized, but I'm not putting an asterisk next to this. But others very much want to. Now, most of those others are in Columbus. But nonetheless, I think it's fair to explore it. So where are you on all this?
Right. Yeah, I'm in a similar place. And I think that, again, not knowing fully what's going to come out, none of us do in the NCAA investigative process as far as what details are gleaned, who's involved, you know, who's really involved versus who's kind of involved. I mean, that was always the question around Jim Harbaugh, is what was he aware of? How much was he directing this, or was he completely in the dark? And these were essentially the actions of a rogue staffer, so to speak, or somebody who was. Everything I've heard about Connor Stallions is he had this sort of obsessive personality where he would just dive into projects and, do anything he could to find every detail that he could. So that's the part that's unknown. But I think, again, you have to look at the scandal now in the context of they won a national championship after this broke and after he was no longer with the program. And presumably they were not doing some of the things they were doing before that this all came out, and they beat the best teams on their schedule. They beat Alabama. They beat Washington to win a national championship, their first in 26 years. So it's impossible to sort of look at the scandal and or the NCAA investigation and not qualify it with, well, yeah, they also won a national championship. They beat Ohio State for the third straight time. So you know, again, I think people are all over the map as far as how much it really mattered. I don't think it didn't matter. There's no reason why Charlie Baker would have taken the steps he did if it was just a nothing burger. And I, you know, Tony Petitti, especially the Big Ten commissioner, having been with MLB when the Astros scandal happened, I think that very much shaped his approach towards Michigan and ultimately the suspension that was handed down for Harbaugh. So it is a serious situation. How serious, we'll find out. How important it was, I don't know if we'll ever know the answer to that, because it's going to be all over the spectrum, as far as some say it really, really matters. Some say it's not that big of a deal. Michigan had really good coaches, really good players, really good schemes. And you saw that in their run to a national championship.
Yeah, that will always hound me. And I tend to be, because of that, again, a little bit more in the camp of, you know, what happened on the field happened on the field, and we're going to go ahead from there and sort of acknowledge them as the national champions. I guess it'll always be a part of it. Listen, I think, you know, sometimes as journalists, we look through this lens, right? When we're telling the story of this team and of Jim Harbaugh, this will be pretty prominent, I would think. You know, even I think of, like, back to the way I wrote my game story the night that they won the national championship. In the, you know, first or second paragraph, I mentioned the scandal and the fact that this thing was hanging over them. Like, so it will always be part of their story. I guess it's the user's choice as how much of a part it needs to be.
Right. Again, if they had fallen apart after the, you know, firing or separation or whatever you want to phrase it with Connor Stallions, then it's like, okay. You know, clearly there's a correlation here, because without him and without what they were doing, they you know, weren't successful against Penn State. And they weren't successful against Ohio State. And they didn't win the Big Ten championship, but they did all of those things. They won the Big Ten again. They beat Ohio State in a very competitive game. And by the way, they did it without their head coach on the sideline. So, you know, again, I refuse to prop them up as a victim or this team that fought through this awful adversity. I mean, listen, it was self-created and it will always be self-created, but I do give them credit for finding a way to win the biggest games of the season and ultimately the biggest games in the program in a generation. I really doubted, Ralph. I don't know if you were here or at this point like I was, but I really wondered if Michigan would ever win another national championship. I just felt that with where they were and where Ohio State was and where Georgia and Alabama and some of these other programs were, I didn't know if they could ever put it all together.
Yeah.
And to their credit, they were able to, and it obviously yielded a very memorable national championship run, doing it in a very different way, honestly, than a lot of the teams that have won the title in the last 10, 15 years.
I am absolutely with you. In fact, I thought the fact that Harbaugh wasn't getting it done there was not as much of an indictment of Harbaugh. I thought it was an indictment of, like, where Michigan stood in the current landscape of college football. Not that it couldn't be a good program or even one of the better programs in the country, but you see the shifting power to the South, and, you know, Ohio State seemed to be better equipped to deal with a national, you know, recruiting base and sort of, you know, recruit like an SEC team, whereas Michigan just was sort of floundering. And I thought, well, if Harbaugh can't do it, because I know that guy's a good coach, his track record says he's a good coach, if he can't do it, no one can. And that's where I had been on Harbaugh and Michigan. Until, of course, the last couple of years when it all came together. And again, it's user's choice as to how much it all coming together in Ann Arbor was influenced by them doing some cheating on the side. So let me flip to Sharon Moore is now the coach. The flurry of activity that happened on the coaching carousel in January seems to have done. There are no openings. You know, we're crossing our fingers here. You never know. Maybe some NFL team will scoop up Chip Kelly as an offensive coordinator.
Oh, God, don't even say it, bro. By the way, can we collectively put together a candidates list for UCLA? Because I'm really struggling. I've thought about that. I know I need to probably get something ready just in case, and I have no idea.
Boy, yeah.
Ooh, maybe by the end of the podcast, we can put together a UCLA candidates list.
You know,
I am lost right now.
You know, the funny thing was, and I almost sort of put two and two together as sort of a detective work here. The best candidate for them might have been Ken Numatalolo, who was on their staff, the former Navy coach who just took the San Jose State job. So I almost found myself thinking, well, let me game this out here. If Chip really thought he was leaving, would he let Ken take that job? You know,
right.
But you're right. Like I have no idea what UCLA will do if Kelly were to skip town there. So, but let's put that aside for a second here. Sharon Moore is the new coach of Michigan. He has already lost the defensive coordinator, which we anticipated. Jesse Minter going with Jim Harbaugh to the NFL. The one that was maybe even a tougher blow because it wasn't a foregone conclusion is Ben Herbert, the strength and conditioning coach, is going with Harbaugh to the NFL. And, you know, like a lot of places, when the program is doing well, the strength and conditioning coach is a pivotal part of a college football program, and he was considered a pivotal part of Michigan. They have done some internal promotions there, so you hope you're kind of doing the same thing you're getting with Sharon, a continuity play. He is going to probably have to hire an offensive coordinator and a defensive coordinator, Adam. So what do you think? Like, where might he go with that? Would he stay inside for defense and let Klingscale and Elston maybe co-defensive coordinator? That seems that's been floated out there. So guy's got some pretty big hires to make for a first-time head coach, 37 years old, who probably doesn't have the most vast Rolodex.
No, he doesn't. Although he does know more coaches than maybe you think for a guy who had never even, you know, been a Power Five position coach until he came to Michigan. I think it was back in 2017, 2018. But he does have some really important hires to make, and you know, certainly defensive coordinator. Given what Jesse did there, and you could certainly say, well, you know, Connor Stallions was helping Jesse, but I mean, Jesse did a phenomenal job at Michigan, and you see the two game plans that he put together for Alabama and Washington especially, just showed how talented he is as a strategy and play caller. You know, so I think, you know, early indications on that job is that Sharon Moore has reached out to some folks in the NFL to gauge their interest. Clint Hurt, who was a Seahawks defensive coordinator, who just took a position coach job in the NFL.
Yeah.
He was a
D-line with the Eagles.
Heard.
Yeah, D-line with the Eagles.
D-line with the Eagles. He, by the way, a giant of
yes.
an individual. I hadn't seen pictures of Clint Hurt when they announced him or when that broke yesterday or earlier this week. I was just like, my goodness, that is a large, large man. But it's not going to be him. It could be somebody else who maybe has ties to the NFL and maybe also ties to Michigan, or they could, like you say, go in house. I think for offensive coordinator, you know, the obvious in-house candidate would be Kirk Campbell, mm-hmm. who did a really nice job moving into the quarterbacks coach role this mm-hmm. year, working with J.J. McCarthy after the firing of Matt Weiss. We forget that happened about a year ago this time. And Sharon Moore was then thrust into being the sole coordinator. And Kirk Campbell, who was an analyst, was promoted to be the quarterbacks coach and obviously did a really nice job helping them do a national title. So I think if they go internal, it'll be Kirk Campbell. If they go external, it'll be very interesting to see, you know, where Sharon would look. But I think it's safe to say that, you know, they're going to maintain their structure. They're still going to want to win with offensive line and running the ball and power football and controlling the clock. You know, they're not going to go to an air. I mean, I guess you can never say never, but they're not going to go to an air raid.
Sure.
I don't think that's who Sharon Moore is as a coach, even prior to linking up with Jim Harbaugh, and it certainly isn't who he was as the coordinator the last couple of years, and certainly this year as the main play caller.
Well, and as much as they have a fair amount of player turnover coming here, and you know, I think they're going to have six offensive linemen who are eligible to be drafted, and all of them might end up being drafted. Nonetheless, the program is still built around those types of players, right? You're not going to switch your offensive philosophy because you're even though, again, you have a high rate of turnover here, you built this roster and the remaining players to sort of be what you have been before. Interesting with, right, the Minter thing, you know, you do wonder, having Moore in there, who is Harbaugh's guy, if that keeps the Harbaugh pipeline open to a some degree, the Harbaugh brothers pipeline internship, right? that has sort of evolved. You know, Mike McDonald, who might be an NFL head coach real soon and was the Baltimore Ravens defensive coordinator, was the Michigan defensive coordinator beforehand. So that's what they want to do. They want to continue that kind of continuity. And so, yeah, when they look into the NFL, you know, in a very simply put, a lot of people, when you talk to them about the Michigan offense the Michigan defense, without going into like the deep X's and O's deep dive, will say it's an NFL defense. And I think what they're nod to is that it could be a little complicated and they could try to do a lot of different stuff, a lot of pre-snap and then switching before the ball is actually, to make it look like one thing and then be another thing. So, I could see them go into the NFL. I wonder, with the offensive side of the ball, if Sherrone could use, you know, listen, the Bill O'Brien, I talked about this a couple of weeks ago. The Bill O'Brien, you know, hiring from Ohio State sort of got panned a little bit among sort of the generic college football Twitter world, because I think for some reason O'Brien has sort of built up a reputation as being a little bit of like a, you know, an underachiever. I don't get that. I don't get that. I think that's a fine hire for Ryan Day to do what he's trying to accomplish, which is like really experienced guy who I can hand the offense to and trust. And I'm wondering if like Sherrone could use that. I understand elevating somebody from within who's done a good job, but boy, if I could, you know, get into Sherrone's head and sort of say, listen, if you could find somebody you're comfortable with who has a lot of experience that you can hand things off to, while maybe even still keeping the play calling. I mean, Ryan Day is trying to get rid of the play calling, and I understand if you're Sherrone, you may want to keep that because that's what got you to this position to a certain degree. I don't know. A long-winded way of me saying, yeah. I think I'd like to see them like go outside and maybe hire someone with a little more experience who could be that old head that Sherrone can bounce ideas off of.
Right. I think it's like, you know, you see this in other places too, either older head coach, young coordinators like Harbaugh had, or young head coach, older coordinators. I think it's hard to have young head coach, young coordinators, especially at a program that's trying to achieve like Michigan is. You saw this a little bit at Ohio State. You know, Ryan Day's a little older than Sherrone Moore is, but bringing in Jim Knowles, who very much is that gray beard, literally, defensive coordinator who you don't have to worry about the defense. He's just going to get it done. And obviously now with Bill O'Brien, he's got two more experienced coaches than he is handling the offense and defense. Whereas Jim Harbaugh, a few times did this with younger coordinator, not so much with like Don Brown, but you look at the Mike McDonald, you know, Josh Gattis to a degree, but even last year, Minter and Moore, both guys are in their mid-30s. So not super experienced, decades and decades of coordinators, and look, it helped them win a national title. So I think it's a good point that, you know, some experience on that staff will help Sherrone, possibly in one of the coordinator spots.
Well, there's also this too. It's this idea of having somebody, maybe, if again, you know, you can wish this, but if there is not an ideal fit, you don't force it. If there's an older head, an older coach with offensive experience who could be the offensive coordinator and also be, again, the guy you bounce ideas off of as a head coach, a guy who has had former head coaching experience, right? So when listen, he'll always have Jim Harbaugh as a sounding board, yes, but Jim Harbaugh has another job. I think when you see these first-time head coaches, younger head coaches, having someone in the building who has maybe done that job before can be helpful. So again, you don't force it. You don't go out and say, I'm going to hire a guy with this profile, regardless of whether he fits and whether I know him and whether I'm comfortable with him. But if he could find that guy, I think that would be helpful. You know who's one of Sherrone Moore's sort of biggest advocates? Sean Watson. Am I getting that name yet? Louisville and Texas, I think, for a little while. And I just like you know, again, like, does that mean he has to go out and hire Sean Watson? No, I don't think that necessarily means that. But I'm like if you look in his, I'd be interested to see if you looked in his past, if he has somebody who's available to him, who could come in and sort of be that, again, that supportive, hey, I've seen it all, I've been through this, here's what I would do kind of sounding board. Because I think, again, I've seen this happen with a lot of other younger coaches, and I think it could be helpful.
Yeah, no, again, I think that's really smart. And you look at, I think about like Notre Dame, Marcus Freeman, you got Al Golden as his defensive coordinator, who I don't think he had a relationship with before he brought him in. And former head coach, obviously, with Miami and Temple. And I think that's been a really good resource for Marcus. So I completely agree. If there's somebody either in a coordinator role or in a special assistant, I mean, you could, these programs have so much money now, they can create positions for anyone.
That's a good point.
And titles for anyone. So if there's somebody like that, I think it would be certainly wise, because this is a big undertaking. Now, you're doing it from a position of strength. You just won a national title. He's got credibility that he's already been at the program for a few years, a decent chunk of years, actually. But it's still, you can only prepare so much for that first job, and his is going to be taking over the defending national champions at one of the highest profile places in all of college football. So you know, again, I think like Jack Swarbrick said when he hired Marcus, you know, you have to endure the growing pains, and I think there's going to be some inevitably, and the word Manuel and Michigan's administration are going to have to go through that with Sharon, but also giving him the best chance he can to succeed with the staffing and with the budgets.
So that's Jerome Moore. That's Michigan. We kind of put that to bed there. By the way, Jerry Kill is sort of like the specialist at that, being that role. He's off the board. Jerry Less landed a job somewhere at Vanderbilt, so he's going to be that guy. He's going to be that guy for Clark Lea over at Vandy. The other big hires, obviously, you had Alabama, of course, with Kalen DeBoer, and then the domino effect of then Washington hiring Jed Fish, and then Arizona hiring Brent Brennan to fill those roles. As we look back, just real quickly on, and sort of, you know, putting a bow on that little spurt of hiring. You know, I we'll find out, right? Just like you said with Sharon Moore, you never, and this goes with everyone, all the coaches, no matter how experienced, inexperienced, no matter where you're coming from, what your record, we don't know how you'll do in the job until you have the job, ultimately, because, you know, a track record of success is usually a good hint that you will figure it out, that you, if you've figured it out at other places, you will figure it out there. But really, all these coaches are a little bit of a roll of the dice, because we really don't know how you'll do that specific job until you have that job. As you look, you know, there was a little bit of panic at Alabama, just, you know, guys going into the portal and then some decommitments. And I think that was probably overstated. There was a little bit of a panic at Arizona that all their players were going to leave. And while I wouldn't, and it looks like a lot of their players are going to stay, though I would caution folks that those players have another window to leave coming up in the spring. So, you know, just understand that they have to get used to those coaches, and what they see during spring ball may influence and change some minds. And now, you know, Washington seems to be, you know, Jed has a lot of rebuilding to do at Washington, even regardless, because that was going to be a big rebuild anyway. As you look over the last couple of weeks, where have you seen maybe signs of, I like what this person is doing, or I like what that person is doing? Now that we've had a couple of weeks to sort of digest the moves and get rid of the initial panic of, oh, my God, what's going to happen with the portal and what's going to happen with this? How do you assess what's going on with those three situations?
Right. So we'll start with the kind of Washington, Arizona one. I mean, I think Arizona, you got indications fairly early in the process that they were not going to lose, you know, Noah Fifita and McMillan and some of their other top players. You know, they did lose a couple of younger guys' commitments to Washington, but so far there hasn't been that exodus to Washington. So I think Brent Brennan, part of this is just, you know, if you ever talk to Brent, he's a super positive guy. He's a guy that I think players generally would want to stay and play for, even if they didn't know him. Now, that might change once they get on the field, like you said, Ralph, in the spring, and then you have another transfer window after that. But I don't anticipate, you know, a huge departure from Arizona, which has a very good team, a team that should absolutely, you know, contend for the Big 12, at least on paper. going into the season as they enter that conference. So I think they're in a pretty good spot. And then for Washington, it was obviously huge for them to retain Will Rogers, who, you know, had committed there from Mississippi State to Kalen DeBoer and Ryan Grubb, who then entered the portal, understandably, after the coaching change, but then has returned to Washington. So they have an idea of who their quarterback's going to be. They obviously have a lot of work to do on the offensive line. I mean, that's the group that, essentially splintered apart either to the NFL or to the portal. I know Ole Miss picked up a couple guys. Alabama picked up Brailsford, is that right?
Yeah, Brailsford, the center.
With Ryan Grubb and Scott Huff going to Alabama, made sense that they were able to pick up at least one of those starters. So that's where the work for Jed and his staff is really going to be. I think the spring portal and working with who's still there is going to be essential. And I think realistically, the expectations for Washington in year one in the Big Ten should be tempered, even though they're coming off of a national runner-up appearance. It's going to be a dramatically different team in a new conference with a new staff who's only been in place since mid-January. So again, I'm not expecting Washington to be in the playoff this year. You look at Alabama, and again, it's so interesting, right? Because this is going to be the first spring in forever without Nick Saban. I like what Kalen DeBoer has done with his staff. I understand, that there's concern about some of the players that they lost, but I also have seen the staff inherit good players and develop players and do it their way. And if they can just stick to that, I think they're going to be fine in the long run. Are they going to go 12-0 this fall? I don't think so. You don't have to go 12-0 anymore. You don't have to go 11-1 anymore. So Alabama to me feels like a team that could very well improve as the season goes along and find itself, maybe a quarter of the way, midway through the season, after some, expected bumps at the start. But, Kalen was able to bring, his coordinator and in Ryan Grubb offense, and then guys like Jamarcus Shepherd and Scott Huff, and then adding, Kane Womack, sitting head coach, adding Maurice Lingris, a sitting head coach, to the defensive staff. It's a pretty exciting group. Even though there's not as many, SEC guys, so to speak, people who have worked in the SEC their whole career. So, again, I've learned to not doubt Kalen DeBoer, Ralph, as someone who's known him for a number of years. And I think in the long run, they're going to be just fine.
Yeah, I think the fascinating parts of this are another fascinating part of this, obviously, with Alabama is you talk about the quarterback position and what Jalen Milroe, like, I think to a certain degree, what DeBoer has made his name on is having this, obviously this great offense with Grubb and lifting Michael Penix up. Now, I don't want to take away Michael Penix's own agency here. Like, Michael Penix is a really good player who finally stayed healthy. And there's a road here where a couple of years down the road, what we might see is, hey, man, like, how much did Kalen DeBoer benefit from having Michael Penix, right? But I think DeBoer has to get some credit for developing Penix into the player that he was. I'm just fascinated to see what he can do with Milroe. If Milroe's got the skill set to necessarily fit well into that offense, and if not, what can DeBoer do to sort of modify things? And it's not like there aren't other players there, right? They brought Austin Mack with them, who was the player that they had thought to a certain degree was going to be the player, the quarterback of the future.
Right.
At Washington, after Will Rogers sort of took that one more season as a transfer, there will be other options because it's Alabama. There's always, not everybody transferred out of Alabama. There's still some four stars rolling around there, even on the quarterback depth chart. So how the quarterback thing plays out is super fascinating to me for Alabama next year. And the other thing, too, and I just wanted to get your thought on this, Adam, is this idea of, and I think it goes to Sherrone, especially when we see Sherrone Moore at Michigan and this idea of keeping the continuity. We are in such a, this thing has always been about what have you done for me lately? I think now it's even more so. We are hyped. We have ramped up the speed in which we have determined whether these guys can do the job. So I do think maybe now more than ever, having a good first season, something that looks like a success in year one, I think becomes even more important because your fan base can be out on you real quick. the what that means for NIL can be damaging real quick, what that means for just momentum in recruiting, and just I think this whole thing can tip very fast. So I'm wondering, like, when you look at the landscape here, is there even more pressure than ever to have, especially, you know, even at a place like Alabama, to make sure your first year, like, we're not giving you a mulligan anymore. Is it more pressure than ever that your first year is a good year?
Yeah, I mean, definitely at Alabama, because they have gotten used to making the four-team playoff every year. So how are they going to feel about missing the 12-team playoff, even with, you know, a new staff and some of the changes? So, I think at Alabama, you got to find a way to get in there if you're Kalen in year one. And that's why I think the improvement is going to be so important. You touched on Milroe as well. You know, working with him, a different type of quarterback than Michael Penix, different type of quarterback than Will Rogers would have been if Kalen had stayed at Washington. So that's going to be very interesting. But I think at Alabama, they're one of those programs that any season where you don't make the playoff is a failure, and it's going to be more pronounced now with additional spots. I mean, you know, imagine being at Georgia and not making the 12-team playoff. They missed the 14 playoff this year. That would be devastating. Mm-hmm. I think for Ryan Day at Ohio State would be devastating if they missed the 12-team playoff in almost any year, especially this year, given what they've put into this roster and this coaching staff. Michigan, that's the one that I don't know. I mean, it's going to be such a different team, but still a team that I guess the thing with Michigan, which is hard to really analyze, Ralph, as we sit here on January 30th, is they don't have a quarterback situation right now. I mean, they have guys that are on that team that play quarterback, but it just doesn't compare to some of these other situations in terms of comfort level. So I have a hard time saying what's a fair expectation for Sharon Moore in year one at Michigan until the quarterback thing gets sorted out. And then, as I said earlier, I think at Washington, this is a year about, you know, preventing a complete fall off and transitioning to the Big Ten. If I'm a Washington fan and I miss the 12-team playoff, I'm not distraught about it, but I want to see some progress as the year goes on. I want to see some gains in the portal and recruiting, and I want to feel good about the chance to make the playoff in 2025. But I don't think this is a playoff or bust year for Jed Fish.
And for Arizona, you know, you're in a weird position of, boy, like, you thought this was going to be your window season, right? Like, you had a chance to maybe be the favorite in the Big 12. And again, they lost some players, but it's not even just losing some players, right? And like, Brent Brennan did a very nice job at San Jose State. And if he's got players to work with, I imagine he will do a pretty good job. But even you could have pretty good players and a pretty good coach and that not work. At least immediately, right? You're going to change some schemes. You're going to, you know, change some philosophies. And it's not like they have a bunch of five stars. Again, they have some very good players, but there's a chance that that might not click. And all of a sudden, your window to win the Big 12, now all of a sudden you're an 8-4 team and you have a pretty good year, but that's not what you signed up for. And what that means after that, you know, again, if I'm an Arizona fan, I'm still, you know, I'm bolstered by the fact that a lot of my guys decided to stay, but still a little nervous that, like, here's my window. We're at Arizona. We're not necessarily going to have this window all the time, that I still might be missing my window. And that'll be a fascinating one because, again, as good a job as Brent Brennan did at San Jose State, it's just a completely different job when you move up to these, well, Power Four programs now. It's just, there's a lot more on your plate now than there ever was before.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as an Arizona fan, you have to balance your greediness, understandably, and desire for a team to maybe make the playoff, which is, you know, unthinkable if you think about where Arizona football was a few years ago, with the importance of establishing a consistent winner and stability. Because I think Brent Brennan is the type of hire who will look at Arizona as a potential destination job. I spoke to Brent the other day, and we were just talking about all of his family connections, and his wife was an athlete there, his brother. So even though he wasn't an Arizona alum, he's very, he understands what Arizona is. He loves it. And I think he's a potential long-term answer there. So, you know, that doesn't mean he's going to have success, but I think there's a chance that, you know, Arizona can, you know, dig itself out of how far it had fallen down under Kevin Sumlin to a place where they're making bowls every, you know, almost every year, and then occasionally challenging for the Big 12. I mean, isn't that a realistic, you know, ceiling type thing for Arizona? Obviously, it would be great to make the playoff, but, you know, I would rather, if I'm an Arizona fan, settle into, okay, we're going to be a team that wins 7 to 9 games a year, because they haven't been that for a really long time.
Yeah, and I think it is realistic, especially in the Big 12, the way it's situated now, because I think the good thing about the Big 12, I mean, if you want to knock the Big 12, you say, hey, I don't know if any of these programs have a national championship level ceiling, but the good part of that, or the positive side of that, is they all have very high, relatively high floors. And if I'm looking around, anybody in the Big 12 should look around at its competition and say, yeah, we could win every year in this conference. And that's again, sort of the good news about being in the Big 12 right now, is I think all those teams look at themselves and think, yeah, we could be a contender every year. Okay, before I let you go, Adam, can we quickly, like in a minute and a half, like, can you think of anybody for UCLA? I'm looking around here. I was just looking at the standings, and I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, where are they going to find a coach if Chip does leave?
I know, and it's still a very desirable job. I mean, my friends and colleagues at SiriusXM were always trying to get Neuheisel back there. maybe that's who they look at. And part of this is the chain reaction, right? Like, Michigan would have possibly come after Kalen DeBoer or Jed Fish, but they'd already taken other jobs. UCLA certainly would have pursued Jed Fish.
Jed Fish, absolutely.
Or Brett Brennan. But, you know, Brett Brennan absolutely has ties to UCLA. Like, why wouldn't they come after him? But he just took a job. So a lot of their candidates are off the board. It's why I'm thinking, you know, maybe there's somebody in the NFL, a coordinator that I'm not thinking about who would make sense there, but there's not a lot of obvious names who have either spent time there or are even from the area. I mean, the irony here, Ralph, is that a couple of years ago, we would have said Dave Aranda at the very top of the list, and I think that's a job that Dave would have interest in. Right. However, Dave's on the hot seat right now at Baylor, yeah, and turned down a bunch of Pac-12 jobs, or at least interest in those jobs, the year they won the Big 12. So, you know, it's one that I have to spend a lot more time thinking about. But anyone who's listening, please, at ESPN Rittenberg on X, send me your UCLA suggestions. I certainly need them.
And we're both, you know, going to be crossing our fingers and toes that it doesn't happen. Not because we care that much about UCLA, just because I think we're done. I think we'd like this all to be over, and we'd like to move on to off-season content. Adam Rittenberg does an amazing job for ESPN. Adam, great job here. Always appreciate your time. Enjoy whatever might be looking like an off season, and hopefully we will bump into each other sooner than rather than later.
Absolutely, Ralph. Always love coming on the show, and enjoy February. And yeah, anytime you want to do this again, I'm ready.
You got it. Thanks, Adam. And now three and out. First down. I want to swing back to Michigan and the sign stealing and come clean on what I would call my bias on this situation. It's not an inclination to defend Michigan or Harbaugh, not my desire to protect an institution or a person here. It's the way I view the world, and especially the world of sports. I want to be able to quantify things in a way that takes much of the guesswork and speculation out of the equation. I don't love relying on anecdotal evidence. Full stop when it comes to sports. I'm someone who wants all the baseball players who have been held out of the Hall of Fame for PED usage in the Hall of Fame, in large part because we can't quantify the advantage it gave those players, especially in the context of playing in a league where steroid use was rampant. Think about Spygate and the Patriots. That will always be part of the legacy of the New England dynasty, but is it enough to disqualify their achievements? I don't think so, especially in the context, again, of a competitive environment where everybody is searching for the slightest advantage, pushing the boundaries of the rules and trying to game systems to find an extra yard or two or a point here or there. That's where I landed with the Astros and their sign stealing. A, show me exactly how much it mattered. B, we can't consider the Astros without acknowledging that sign stealing through video became rampant throughout the major leagues after replay was installed. The way the Astros were doing it crossed the line, and they were duly punished for their cheating. But in a world where everybody is doing this or some version of this, it's common knowledge throughout the league. Aren't teams also putting safeguards in place? The Astros cheated and were punished, but I have never thought that disqualified all their other accomplishments. By the way, in case you didn't know, I'm a Mets fan. I have no allegiance to the Astros other than after the scandal, I found myself pulling for them, but mostly because I knew them winning pissed off a bunch of people. So in that case, my bias, so to speak, was being a contrarian. My opinion of the Astros might be different had they beaten my Mets in one of those World Series. That's where I stand on Michigan. I can't quantify the advantage. The nature of the infraction is hard to weigh. When it starts with sign stealing is legal and it is pervasive, but if you do it this way, it's wrong and will be punished. Well, I tend to agree with my frenemy Ari Wasserman, who wrote a column about a week and a half ago saying if you're complaining about sign stealing and Michigan, you're basically just being a sore loser. I tend to agree with that, but I also find myself thinking that might be a little too harsh. If you're looking for outrage about Michigan's cheating or almost any cheating in high-level sports, you're just not going to find it here from me. But that doesn't mean you're not entitled to feel that way. Second down. We mentioned the new look Big 12 with Adam, and coincidentally, the conference released its 9-game schedule as a 16-team league with the additions of Utah, Arizona, Arizona State, and of course, Deion Sanders in Colorado while we were taping. Coach Prime is not going to be quite the lightning rod that he was last year, but it is still a really fascinating program to watch. Very notable, the Buffs opened the season at home against North Dakota State. Now, the Bison are a few years removed from their dynastic best and transitioning to a new head coach and offensive coordinator. So before you go penciling in CU for an L, this might not be the North Dakota State that college football fans have grown to know and fear. Also circling CU's return trip to Nebraska in week 3 as one to remember. Dylan Raiola versus Coach Prime will be one to watch and one that will drive the tap the brakes crowd out of their minds, no doubt. And of course, the best thing about the new Big 12 schedule, BYU-Utah is now an annual event. Next season, the Holy War will be played on November 9th. Mark your calendars there. Third down. Hugh Freeze hired DJ Durkin to be the new defensive coordinator at Auburn. Durkin, you might recall, was fired at Maryland, where he was the head coach, after the death of a player during summer conditioning, which led to scrutiny on the way he was running his program, as it turns out, not very well. Durkin, a fortuitous Jimmy Sexton client, has been bouncing around the SEC over the last couple of years, first Ole Miss and last year A&M. He got some shine for turning around a bad Ole Miss defense under Lane Kiffin, which is a good example of why it's not the worst idea to take a job in coaching with a unit that has been terrible. You see, it doesn't take much to qualify as a turnaround that you get to take credit for when you go from bad to mediocre. At A&M, Durkin didn't do anything particularly notable while having some grade-A defensive talent. He was let go after the coaching change in College Station from Jimbo Fisher to Mike Elko. Now, Durkin has another soft landing spot with Auburn. it could work out just fine. I'm not saying he's a bad coach, but I do think Durkin is a good example of how important it is to have strong advocates and influential friends in that business. That's the show for today. I'd like to thank my producer, John Radcliffe, for making me sound good. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you like to get your pods. Please follow. Please, 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 so you don't miss an episode. I'm Ralph Russo, college football writer with the Associated Press. Thanks for listening, and come back for more next week of the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast.